the President of the United States. President McClure, Governor Donnelly, ladies and gentlemen, you know, this is one of the greatest pleasures and privileges I have had since I have been President of the United States. I appreciate most highly Governor Donnelly's welcome to Mr. Churchill and myself, and I'm very thankful that Dr. McClure suggested to me that Mr. Churchill be invited to deliver this lecture today. I had a letter from Mr. Churchill 6 months ago or more, in which he said he was considering a vacation in the United States or in North Africa. I sent him Dr. McClure's invitation and made a longhand note on the bottom of it, telling him that if he would spend his vacation in the United States at whatever point he chose to pick, and then would deliver this lecture, I would make it a point to come to Missouri and personally welcome him and introduce him for that lecture. I had never met Mr. Churchill personally until the Berlin conference between Mr. Stalin, Mr. Churchill, and myself. I became very fond of both of them. They are men, and they are leaders in this world today when we need leadership. It's a pleasure to me to introduce Mr. Churchill. He's one of the great men of the age. He's a great Englishman. He's a great Englishman, but he's half American. Mr. Churchill and I believe in freedom of speech. I understand that Mr. Churchill is going to talk on the sinews of peace. I know that he will have something constructive to say to the world in that speech. I am happy that he came here to deliver it, and it's one of the great privileges of my lifetime to be able to present to you that great world citizen, Winston Churchill. President McClure, ladies and gentlemen, and last, but certainly not least, President of the United States of America, I am very glad indeed to come to Westminster College this afternoon, and I am complimented that you should give me a degree from an institution whose reputation has been so solidly established. The name Westminster, somehow or other, seems familiar to me. I feel as if I've heard of it before. Indeed, now that I come to think of it, it was at Westminster that I received a very large part of my education in politics,
dialectic, rhetoric, and one or two other things. So, in fact, we have both been educated at the same or similar, or at any rate kindred, establishment. It is also an honor, ladies and gentlemen, perhaps almost unique, for a private visitor to be introduced to an academic audience by the President of the United States. Amid his heavy burdens, duties, and responsibilities, unsought but not recoiled from, the President has traveled 1,000 miles to dignify and magnify our meeting here today. And to give me an opportunity of addressing this kindred nation, as well as my own countrymen across the ocean, and perhaps some other countries too. The President has told you that it is his wish, as I'm sure it is yours, that I should have full liberty to give my true and faithful counsel in these anxious and baffling times. Now, I shall certainly avail myself of this freedom and feel the more right to do so because any private ambition I may have cherished in my younger days have been satisfied beyond my wildest dreams. Let me, however, make it clear that I have no official mission or status of any kind. I speak only for myself. There is nothing here but what you see. I can therefore allow my mind, with the experience of a lifetime, to play over the problems which beset us on the morrow of our absolute victory in arms, and to try to make sure, with what strength I have, that what has been gained with so much sacrifice and suffering shall be preserved for the future glory and safety of mankind. Ladies and gentlemen, the United States stands at this time at the pinnacle of world power. It is a solemn moment for the American democracy. For with primacy in power is also joined an awe-inspiring accountability to the future. If, as you look around you, you must feel not only the sense of duty done, but also you must feel anxiety lest you fall below the level of achievement. Opportunity is here now, clear and shining for both our countries. To reject it or ignore it or fritter it away would bring upon us all the long reproaches of the after time. It is necessary that constancy of mind, persistency of purpose, and the grand simplicity of decision should rule and guide the conduct of the English-speaking peoples in peace as they did in war. And we must, and I believe we shall, prove ourselves equal to this severe requirement. When American military men approach some serious situation, they are wont to write at the head of their directive the words, overall strategic concept. There is wisdom in this. as it leads to clarity of thought. What then is the overall strategic concept which we should inscribe today? It is nothing less than the safety and welfare, the freedom and progress of all the homes and families of all the men and women in all the land. And here I speak particularly of the myriad cottage or apartment homes where the wage earner strives amid the accidents and difficulties of life to guard his wife and children from privation and bring the family up in the fear of the Lord, or upon ethical conceptions which often play their potent part. To give security to these countless homes, they must be shielded from the two gaunt marauders, war and tyranny. We all know the frightful disturbance in which the ordinary family is plunged when the curse of war swoops down upon the breadwinner and those for whom he works and contrives. The awful ruin of Europe, with all its vanished glories, and the large parts of Asia, blurs us in the eyes. When the designs of wicked men, or the aggressive urge of mighty states, dissolve over large areas the frame of civilized society, humble folk are confronted with difficulties with which they cannot cope. For them all is distorted, all is broken, all is even ground to pulp. When I stand here this quiet afternoon, I shudder to visualize what is actually happening to millions now, and what is going to happen in this period when famine stalks the earth. None can compute what has been called the unestimated sum of human pain. Our supreme task and duty is to guard the homes of the common people from the horrors and miseries of another war. We are all agreed on that. Our American military colleagues, after having proclaimed their overall strategic concept and computed available resources, always proceed to the next step, namely the method. Here again, there is widespread agreement. A world organization has already been erected for the prime purpose of preventing war. You know, UNO, the successor of the League of Nations, with the decisive addition of the United States and all of that means, is already at work. We must make sure that its work is fruitful, that it is a reality and not a sham, that it is a force for action, and not merely a crossing of words, that it is a true temple of peace in which the shields of many nations can someday be hung up, and not merely a cockpit in a Tower of Babel. Before we cast away the solid assurances of national armaments for self-preservation, we must be certain that our temple is built not upon shifting sands or quagmires, but upon the rock. Anyone can see with his eyes open that our path will be difficult and also long. But if we persevere together, as we did in the two world wars, though not alas in the interval between them, I cannot doubt that we shall achieve our common purpose in the end. I have, however, a definite and practical proposal to make for action. Courts and magistrates may be set up, but they cannot function without sheriffs and constables. The United Nations organization must immediately begin to be equipped with an international armed force. In such a matter, we can only go step by step, but we must begin now. I propose that each of the powers and states should be invited to dedicate a certain number of air squadrons to the service of the World Organization. These squadrons will be trained and prepared in their own countries, but would move around in rotation from one country to another. They would wear the uniforms of their own countries, but with different badges. They would not be required to act against their own nation. But in other respects, they would be directed by the World Organization. This might be started on a modest scale, and it would grow as confidence grew. I wish to see this done after the First World War, and I devoutly trust that it may be done forthwith. It would nevertheless, ladies and gentlemen, be wrong and imprudent to entrust the secret knowledge or experience of the atomic bomb, which the United States, Great Britain, and Canada now share, to the World Organization while it is still in its infancy. It would be criminal madness to cast it adrift in this still agitated and ununited world. No one in any country... No one in any country has slept less well in their beds because this knowledge and the method and the raw materials to apply it are at present largely retained in American hands. I do not believe we should all have slept so soundly had the positions been reversed and some communist or neo-fascist state monopolized for the time being these great agents. The fear of them alone might easily have been used to enforce totalitarian systems upon the free democratic world, with consequences appalling the human imagination. God has willed that this shall not be, and we have at least a breathing space to set our house in order before this peril has to be encountered. And even then, if no effort is spared, we should still possess so formidable a superiority as to impose effective deterrence upon its employment or threat of employment. Ultimately, when the essential brotherhood of man is truly embodied and expressed in a world organization, with all of the necessary practical safeguards to make it effective, these powers would naturally be confided to that world organization. Now I come to the second of the two marauders, to the second danger which threatens the cottage home and ordinary people, namely tyranny. We cannot be blind to the fact that the liberties enjoyed by individual citizens throughout the United States and throughout the British Empire are not valid in a considerable number of countries, some of which are very powerful. In these states, control is enforced upon the common people by various kinds of all-embracing police government to a degree which is overwhelming and contrary to every principle of democracy. The power of the state is exercised without restraint, either by dictators or by compact oligarchies operating through a privileged party and a political police. It is not our duty at this time, when difficulties are so numerous, to interfere forcibly in the internal affairs of countries which we have not conquered in war. But we must never cease to proclaim in fearless tones the great principles of freedom and the rights of man, which are the joint inheritance of the English-speaking world, and which through Magna Carta, the Bill of Rights, the habeas corpus, trial by jury, the English common law, find their most famous expression in the American Declaration of Independence. All this means that the people of any country have the right and should have the power by constitutional action, by free, unfettered elections, with secret ballot, to choose or change the character or form of government under which they dwell. That freedom of speech and thought should reign. That courts of justice, independent of the executive, unbiased by any party, should administer laws which have received the broad assent of large majorities or are consecrated by time and custom. Here are the title deeds of freedom which should lie in every cottage home. Here is the message of the British and American peoples to mankind. Let us preach what we practice. Let us practice what we preach. Sir, I have now stated the two great dangers which menace the homes of the people. War and tyranny. I have not yet spoken of poverty and privation, which are in many cases the prevailing anxiety. But if the dangers of war and tyranny are removed, there is no doubt that science and cooperation can bring in the next few years, certainly in the next few decades, to the world, newly taught in the sharpening school of war, an expansion of material well-being beyond anything that has yet occurred in human experience. Now, at this sad and breathless moment, we are plunged in the hunger and distress which are the aftermath of our stupendous struggle. But this will pass, and may pass quickly. And there is no reason, except human folly, or subhuman crime, which should deny to all the nations the inauguration and enjoyment of an age of plenty. I have often used words which I learned 50 years ago from a great Irish-American orator, a friend of mine, Mr. Bert Cochran. There is enough for all. The earth is a generous mother. She will provide in plentiful abundance food for all her children, if they will but cultivate her soil in justice and in peace. And so far, I feel that we are in full agreement. Now, while still pursuing the method of realizing our overall strategic concept, I come to the crux of what I have traveled here to say.